I am the best wrestler in the world. I've been the best ever since day one when I walked into this company, and I've been vilified and hated since that day because Paul Heyman saw something in me that nobody else wanted to admit. I've grabbed so many of Vincent K. McMahon's imaginary brass rings that it's finally dawned on me that they're just that. They're completely imaginary. The only thing that's real is me, and the fact that day in and day out for almost 6 years I have proved to everybody in the world that I am the best on this microphone, in that ring, even at commentary. Nobody can touch me.
Hey there, wrestling fans, it is I, C.M. Jew, the best Jew in the world, here with a brand new episode of C.M. Jew's Wrestling Reviews. This is episode 51, and which means it's officially the road to episode 100. Oh yeah, well, we got 49 more to go, so I'll be there in like 3 years, the rate I'm going. But episode 51, after the epic episode 50, I made a decision. You know what I haven't reviewed in a long, long, long time? Some good old WCW. And this week, we go to one of the greatest and classic pay-per-views that WCW ever held, the Great American Bash. And this time out, the bash that we will be covering is, without a doubt, one that can be called a classic. Because if nothing else, if not only having a premiere showing of classic wrestlers of the 80s, it was also a showcase of wrestlers of the future. And I'm not just talking about wrestlers of the future for WCW. I'm talking about a wrestler in particular, a phenom, if you will, that would be the flag carrier for the WWE for the next two decades. I'm of course talking about The Undertaker, known here as Mark Callis. So many other WWE superstars are part of this. So many WCW classic superstars. It's like, oh my god. This is all amazing. It's just a great pay-per-view. So this week, The Great American Bash 1990 New Revolution is what we're going to review. It's going to be fun. Before we get to that, let's talk about wrestling, because I haven't talked about it in a while. You know, we had fun, episode 50. We've had some announcements and everything. You know, finally, the NXT Divas have made it to Raw. We're all happy about that. Though, the only thing I just can't stand about that segment was Stephanie McMahon being there. I understand both points of view, but to me, it's like, everybody hates her. Everybody wants to see her get her ass kicked. And it's like, why couldn't it be Triple H? Yeah, everybody wants to see Triple H get his ass kicked. But it's that thing like, yeah, we want to see him get his ass kicked for some of the diabolical stuff, but we still love him. We don't want to see his ass kicked that much. We know he can handle it. Stephanie, on the other hand, we need to call and get Bubba Ray in here now so he can powerbomb her through a table. I'm just saying. It's like, if we really want to cement the goodness that WWE is having right now, Bubba Ray needs the power. It seems like every time Bubba Ray powerbombs a woman of authority to a table, the promotion gets good. It happened with TNA, albeit far too late for it to really save itself. And we need it to happen again here. Though in this case, it's for the Divas division to actually get good, but that's besides the point. Anyways. Yeah. But there's a little bit of news that dropped this past Thursday. And by the way, I just wanted to close. I did have planned on doing 4 episodes this month. I'm probably only going to do 2. A lot of it has to do with what time I have to watch the pay-per-view, because I like to watch the actual pay-per-view. And it's just that with this one, it just took me like 2 weeks. I just got busy with stuff as I'm preparing for Otakon, which is really the big thing. I'm going to be gone for 5 days. That's 5 days of where I'm not going to be watching anything. So, and I've been primarily focused on Tom Prerogative, which I've been like neglecting a lot, and I want to get that back on track. So, you know, I've been busy with a lot of things. And I'm probably going to be busy throughout the summer, just to let people know, preparing for my new college I'm going to and everything. Once I get into the group of things, I'll probably be back on track. But as such, this past Thursday, we heard a little bit of news. That news is that the legendary Jushin Thunder Liger is going to be at NXT TakeOver Brooklyn. Brooklyn! Yo, all my homies, and roll your 40s. It's prime time! But no, Jushin Thunder Liger at NXT TakeOver. Take my fucking money now and shut the fuck up. Or let me do it. Shut the fuck up and take my money now. You have it. And I love Triple H's tweet afterwards. It's like, do you need any more reasons to buy tickets to NXT TakeOver? Like, I need another reason to buy, but thank you. Too bad I can't, but that's besides the point. There's that. I mean, by the way, how awesome would it be if they actually, if the match he's in is Samoa Joe versus Jushin Thunder Liger? Oh my god, there would not be enough pants in the world. And because we've already had the announcement of the rematch. Kevin Owens versus Finn Balor for the NXT title. I'm going to make a prediction that at some point, somehow, there's going to be a tag team championship match where Enzo Amore and Colin Cassidy will face Team Dubstep, as I like to call them. That's going to happen. You know, as soon as they lost at the last NXT pay-per-view, I'm like, yeah, they're waiting until, if it's been announced that it's going to be in Brooklyn, they're waiting until Brooklyn to give them the titles. I just for that, I cannot wait. I cannot wait to see the pop that Enzo and Cassidy get in Brooklyn. Oh my god, that place is going to... there's going to be a number of times the roof is going to blow off the Barclays Center. That's going to be one of them. But I'm like, it's over. NXT's going to do it again. They're going to upstage the pay-per-view that is going to happen literally a day after it. And the thing that's really funny about this is that it's SummerSlam, the second greatest pay-per-view of the year. Oh my god, they're going to do it again. It's TLC 2014 all over again. Oh. I mean, mind you, I think this is a good thing, though, because I'm joking about that, but there is a high probability that people are going to say, yeah, the NXT event before was better. And that's really going to be putting people... And you know what? I think it's come to light that really when you look at it, NXT has forced the main roster to step up its game. I mean, all in all, for the most part, this past year, I mean, building up and storylines haven't been as good, but the wrestling has been spectacular the entire year in the main roster, at least from my perspective. And it's just, you know, it's, and I'm not just talking about the John Cena segments, I'm just talking in general. I mean, if you did not watch SmackDown this past week, the Rusev-Cesaro match was, oh my god, amazing. And it's just, you know, I really think the NXT and how good they're doing, it's forcing WWE to step up. It's that internal, you know, I had the word on top of my tongue, but it's the sort of internal rivalry that's causing that, you know, again, when WWE was going to go WCW, it was that thing where, you know, we got to be better than them or we're not going to survive the next day. And so there was that constantness to want to be good, to want to be great. And we saw that again when WCW went out of business and WWE eventually needed to find a way, they came up with the brand split. And you basically had SmackDown and Raw competing against each other to be better than the other. And really, since 2008, 2009 even, particularly when they really stopped doing the brand split, that was something that was missing. There wasn't that competition. There wasn't that thing that's to force the, you know, who was really going to challenge WWE. I mean, as good as TNA was at that time, and were trying to, nobody knew they weren't going to challenge. They were never a threat. There really wasn't that challenge there. Now you got a lot of established superstars who know that, you know, if I want to keep my job, you know, I'm going to have to be good because I got these young, hungry superstars who are ready to take my spot down at NXT. And it's wonderful to see the competition. So, yeah, NXT TakeOver Brooklyn is going to be fucking awesome. It's like that list is, oh, like superstars you thought you would never, ever, ever see in the WWE just keeps getting smaller. We'll never see El Generico. Oh, there's El Generico. We'll never see Kenta. There's Kenta. Oh, well, we'll never see Prince. There goes Devitt. Now Finn Balor. Like, well, but Kevin Owens is too bad. There's Kevin Owens. Like, maybe not next on the list, but on that list was Jushin Thunder Liger. And it's like, well, there goes another one. I mean, Samoa Joe's here now. Well, there's another one. It's like Triple H has the list that we have compiled over the years of wrestlers we thought would never be in the WWE. And it's like Triple H has the same exact list that we do. And he's like, just strike. Let me get this one. So I just want to say, Papa Triple H, thank you. Thank you, Papa Triple H. You make me so happy. Oh, I just want to know, how are you going to afford all the brass ring, or how are you going to afford to replace all of the brass rings you're obviously going to be losing on NXT? I just need to know. So, and you know, it's funny we talk about NXT because our review today, The Great American Bash, 1990, New Revolution, really is, when you watch it, it's showcased for some older stars as well. It's really a showcase for all of NWA and for the new stars that were coming down the pike, like Sting, like Lex Luger, like the Steiner Brothers, have been there, but they were really starting to get as the premier tag team. So it just, And you had, like, established classics like the Midnight Express, the Rock and Roll Express. Again, new tag teams, mind you, Doom was one of them. It's just, again, just an older superstar like Iron Sheik's in this. And Captain... I need to find his name now. Mike Rotunda's, and it's just like, there's so many great names, and we can't wait to go over them. And it's just, the thing about going into this review, I just want to let know before I give the tale of the tape, is that one thing that was interesting is that this was really promoted and really comment. By the way, your commentators were Jim Ross and I want to say Scully. No, it wasn't Scully. I can't remember. Oh, damn it, I can't remember for the life of me. Unfortunately, I can't find it, but it's Jim Ross and one of the early commentators. And, yeah, they really make it. They really showcase this as that premiere show. And it was just so fun to listen to Jim Ross do what he was born to do, my friend. As Matt Stryker once said earlier this year. It's just, it was great. So, ladies and gentlemen, let's get into it. WCW The Great American Bash 1990 with the tagline of The New Revolution. Actually, the proper promotion is at this time it still was the National Wrestling Alliance. It took place on July 7th, 1990. Now, it says here attendance of 10,000, though. At the pay-per-view, they were saying the attendance was 15,000. But it took place at the Baltimore Arena in Baltimore, Maryland. Ladies and gentlemen, let's get into The Great American Bash 1990. Welcome back, folks, and let's get right into the bash here with our first match of the evening. And really, what a good way to start it off, as Flying Brian Pillman faced off against the Nature Boy. Not that one, but the Nature Boy, Buddy Landell. And I find it interesting that I oddly chose this pay-per-view, of course not knowing about this match, but choosing this pay-per-view and this match being on it. And of course, about a month ago, we lost the Nature Boy, Buddy Landell. We lost a couple of good ones in the past, like month or two, with Dusty Rhodes and Nature Boy, Buddy Landell, a couple of others. So I never really got to see the Nature Boy, Buddy Landell, wrestle. And so this was a chance for me to watch that and see, you know, again, what he was all about. And I thought both him and Pillman did a really good match. It was a great contrast of styles. Really good opening match to get the crowd into it. With Brian trying to fly over the place and Buddy Landell, of course, being the heel and doing every dirty trick in the book he could think of to try to keep him grounded. And then, of course, the end of the match, I just saw it had great flow to it, to where Landell thinks he gets rid of him. But Pillman lands on his feet, gets to the rope, does the flying body splash for the pin. The crossbody, if you will. It was a really good opening match. And, you know, I think it really got the crowd into it from the start. Our next match has a lot of nostalgic, especially for those who listen to this podcast, knowing that we have reviewed WrestleMania 1. As the Captain, Mike Rotunda, faced off against the Iron Sheik, baby! The original suplex machine! Sheik number one, United States, a boy. Nostalgic moment for this match, really. I mean, even though it was only like 5 years ago that that match happened, but still, just very nostalgic. And again, it just, this match has had so much action. You know, there was a lot of matches that were under 10 minutes, but it just felt like they had so much meat to it. It's something we talked about before, and I talk about all the time about, you know, how much action is going on, how fast paced, and how you keep the flow going can make a match feel longer than it really is, which is sometimes a good thing, because you felt like so much was packed into it. It's like, oh wow, this is only 5 minutes? And you know, I'm exhausted. And then there's the matches that just drag on, and they feel like they're 10 minutes when they were only 5 minutes. It's like, nothing's happening. Can something happen, please? I'm bored. It's like, wow. You know, I think a good way to say it is, like, a great match will feel like 10 minutes when it's 5 minutes, whereas a bad match will feel like it's 20 minutes when it's really 5 minutes. And again, all these matches are good. And again, really kept to chops and wrestling holds and, you know, not a lot of fancy maneuvers. I mean, we'll see some unique maneuvers and suplexes and everything as the night goes on, which is great, and this one's no different. You know, you had a lot of variations on suplexes, not just the standard, you know, vertical suplex or snap suplex, or I should say snap vertical suplex, I mean, but, you know, you some belly-to-belly, some T-bones were thrown in on this match, and just the Sheik and Rotundo had a great chemistry there, really played off that whole USA versus the world vibe, that, you know, that whole patriotism aspect, that especially in those days worked very, very well as an angle for why you should cheer for this wrestler against this wrestler. And they just had a lot of momentum with them, and they kept the action fast paced, and just, you know, even though the match was only like 6 minutes and 46 seconds, it's like, it's one of those matches, like I said, it felt like it was 10 minutes long. It felt like it was longer. And just a really good match. And just really, all these matches are just a joy to watch. I was never bored at any match. Our next match, though, was really fun for me. As Doug Furness faced off against Dirty Dutch Mantel. Now, if you don't know who Dirty Dutch is, allow me to give you a bit of a clue here. You know them illegal aliens. They like to sneak across our border. Well, I want to be there to tell them, we the people. That's right, it's Zeb Coulter. Alright, for those who know that his original wrestling name was Dirty Dutch Mantel, you're not surprised. But for those who may be listening who didn't, yes, Zeb Coulter, back when he was wrestling, was known as Dirty Dutch Mantel. And this was just a fun match. I mean, really, a longer match than I thought might go. A solid 11-minute plus match. And just a great back and forth. Mantel was just great in just being that dirty heel. Has a hairy back. I mean, JR and the other nuts are just made absolute fun of it at the beginning. With his beard and everything, it just made me laugh. I'm like, if you think Prince Albert was hairy, whoo! There's not a comb in the world that can say that can make that look nice. And there's not enough baby oil in the world either. But Doug Furness just looked as that great, powerful face. And, you know, Dutch and him went back and forth. And I really love the endings, the setup to it, into the belly-to-belly suplex, which would probably be better known as the Pittsburgh Plunge by, you know, Shane Douglas, which is exactly what it is. It's not an overhead, but it's that one, and then where you pick them up and then slam them down, belly to belly, put a 1, 2, 3, And again, just very competitive, very athletic. It's the thing that all these matches really gave the illusion of was athleticism. And these felt like all fights. They felt very athletic. It blurred that line between this is a, you know, this is all staged and all story. Which certainly in these days there wasn't a focus on that. Even though they knew they were playing characters. But that ability to blur the line to make it feel like this is really sport. That they're really trying to hurt each other. And so every wrestler here did a great job of blurring that line. So really, really solid match. If you want to see Dirty Dutch Mantel actually wrestle, if you want to see Zeb Coulter, I should say, back when he was wrestling and see one of his matches, I think this is a great place to come and see one of his matches, if you want to see what one of his matches was like. Once again, we have another nostalgic match in our next match, as Harley Race faced off against Tommy Rich. This actually was about the same amount of time as Rotunda and the Sheik. And of course, for NWA fans, this was a very nostalgic match, as back in 1980, Tommy Wildfire Rich actually defeated Harley Race for the NWA World Heavyweight title, which he would eventually win back, and then, of course, eventually Ric Flair would win it from him eventually. And they would go back and forth on it as well. Really solid match again. Even though I wasn't around in 1980 and I didn't see that original match, I still could understand the sort of nostalgic factor of it. And I'd seen Harley Race wrestle enough. And, you know, you had that classic Harley Race knee and the classic knee face buster to the knee maneuver. So there were moves like I knew. I'm like, oh, I know that move. And they had great chemistry together. And then again, the roll up and the clean finish by the heel. It's something else. It's like, I mean, there are heel maneuvers, but not like the obvious like pulling of the tights. It's like, it's more like when the heels use dirty maneuvers to win during this pay-per-view, it's the distraction that takes the focus off the wrestler and onto whatever the distraction is, so the wrestler can hit the big move to set up the win. Mind you, though, there's also faces that will do that, as you will soon see. Coming up next is actually what ends up being my favorite match. Just because of the energy in it and everything. But it's also interesting to note, because it is now going to be a time capsule with the whole political thing. If you are listening to this and you're not in the United States, though I'm sure you've probably seen on the news, and even those in the United States would know this because they've seen it on the news, but the whole debate about the Confederate flag that's going on, you know, because of the horrific mass shooting in South Carolina. I don't want to get too much into politics because I don't feel that's my place at a podcast. Or at least with this particular podcast, there are certain podcasts where I feel more comfortable talking about political issues, one in particular. But in this case, I don't want to get too much into the political issue, but I'll plainly state my side. And I think it's a side that a lot of sort of people to try to take a more common sense approach to this discussion take. And that is, I think the flag should have came down in South Carolina because it's a symbol of the treasonous ideas of... It's a symbol of slavery and a symbol of, you know, the treason of the Confederate States against the Union in that setting. But when it's like on something like the General Lee or it's on a shirt, then it's sort of that Southern lifestyle. It may have came from racist beginnings, but like on the context of the General Lee, you know, it represents sort of Southern living, and it's just that Southern heritage that they're trying to change as a positive image. Again, so going into sort of the political discussion here, you know, the idea that you can change something from a negative to a positive. Again, and I'll leave it at that. If you really want a good look into this discussion, Richie Branson, who I brag about all the time, great guy. I love that he's come on my Tom Prerogative podcast and everything. He posted, I believe on Facebook, a really, really good sort of, I don't want to say discussion, but viewpoint on this as somebody who is African American and, again, takes that more common sense approach. I think it flying on the Capitol is racist and everything, but I am completely comfortable with it being on something like a t-shirt or on the General Lee. And there's a whole big discussion, and I bring that up, you may be wondering, because of this match. The match is the Midnight Express, the current NWA United States Tag Team Champions of Bobby Eaton and Stan Lane, versus the Southern Boys of Tracy Smothers and Steve Armstrong of the legendary Bullet Bob Armstrong family, you know, which is very important to us WWE fans, as that's the family that gave us the Road Dogg, Jesse James. Oh, you didn't know? Well, you better call somebody. I bring it up because, again, the Southern Boys come out in costumes. Not costumes, but they come out with jackets that have embroidered, glitterized Confederate flags on the back. Again, that was their gimmick. They were the good old Southern Boys. Da-da-da. I can't sing the Dukes of Hazzard theme song. And I guess that's why I kind of felt to bring it up. I think, you know, because of the debate, and so many fans, I'm sure so many fans are split on this. I just look at it as, again, a time capsule. And in this case, it's more of a symbol of Southern heritage than it is a symbol of racism on the jackets. And again, I want to express, I really wish that people would not, like, be so offended by those symbols, again, considering the time frame in which this happened, because this was just a wonderful match full of energy. Just back and forth between the Midnight Express, who were the villains, we, of course, with Jim Cornette and, you know, and the Southern Boys, and just back and forth, and it's like there's... Usually this can be a bad thing for the match, where you're confused just exactly who's legal and everything. You could tell who's legal, but it's just like... Each team is like just jumping in at the, you know, slightest moment to help their partner. You could sometimes be confused who's legal, but it would always get cleared out and become obvious. And it's, you know what? It reminded me of sort of the clips I've seen of the Freebirds versus the Von Erichs. That sort of kinetic energy that made me want to go and watch those matches. And that's what this match had. It had that kinetic energy that was just addictive. And you could feel it. The crowd during this pay-per-view, this entire pay-per-view, was just on point and excellent. I'm like, I kept thinking, like, when did the ECW... This was the ECW crowd before ECW. Some of these people probably ended up living in Philadelphia and were part of ECW. But particularly with this match, like, half the crowd was for the Midnight Express, the other half was for the Southern Boys, and just the back and forth and cheering. I was like, oh my god, the energy in this match is wonderful. And it's just fun and just nice and clean and simple, and just had the kinetic sort of brawling energy to it. Like, the Midnight Express would come down, and they would wrestle the Southern Boys down, but the Southern Boys... The wild-eyed Southern Boys, as they were called, when they would get in, they would get their turn, would just go, excuse the pun, they would go wild. And it just had this fun energy, and I highly suggest watching this match. It's just so much fun to watch. Of course, the wicked ending to where, you know, Stan with the martial arts kick to the back of the head, that sets up, Smothers getting, you know, again, Smothers, again, another, you know, future member of the FBI with Little Guido, even though Smothers probably couldn't find Italy on a map, as Joey Styles would say. And it, I always loved when Tracy would, like, moonwalk, and that made me laugh as much. Interestingly enough, we have a very big important date that happens after this match, as Big Van Vader would make his WCW / NWA debut against Tom Zeke, a.k.a. the Z-Man. This was a squash match, ended in 2 minutes 16 seconds. I really love Vader's entrance here with the sort of samurai gear, and then, of course, the, you know, the bowing down, and it's just smoked. It just had this, like, wow, that was really impressive. That had sort of mystic elements to it that I found really impressive. Of course, not in his, what would be his, the mask that Vader would be known for, but rather a black mask red over the mask that he would wear in Japan, mind you. And just a quick squash match, but again, there's good squash matches and there are bad squash matches. There are squash matches to where, like, we want to keep this wrestler relevant to the crowd, but we have nothing to do with him. Well, we'll just give him this simple 3-minute match. I'm like, yeah, they can cheer for him and they'll know he's relevant. Then there are matches, squash matches, the good ones, that are about setting up the sometimes whether it be destructive nature of a big bad wrestler, or really introducing a wrestler and what he can do to a crowd. This is one of those. Like, this match just completely left no doubt in anybody's minds just who Vader was. And they really, I think, if squash matches were like that, I think it did a really good job of setting up just who Vader was to the WCW crowd. Our next match is another fun tag team match, as the Steiner brothers of Rick and Scott faced off against the fabulous Freebirds of Jimmy Garvin and Michael P.S. Hayes, future Hall of Famer. I'm just going to sit here and say this. WWE, if Michael P.S. Hayes does not go into the Hall of Fame in Dallas, I will personally go up to Connecticut and beat somebody's ass. I'm just saying that right now. Michael P.S. Hayes needs to be in the goddamn Hall of Fame, like 5 years ago at the very least. This was just another fun match. Great energy. One of the fun things, again, watching this match, watching the Steiners just dominate a lot and trying to find, at the Freebirds, trying to find through underhanded ways to get around them. And it had a great back and forth. Eventually, the Freebirds would get the upper hand and they would take control. But then the Steiners came back again, and just the start of that match, where like Scott was in control, and there was a great point where Scott like chases him out, and then of course Rick comes in, does that thing to where like he's sitting on top of his brother, who's on all fours, going. I was like, "Wow, we now know where the dog face gremlin name came from," and then of course all the wonderful maneuvers that the Steiners do, you know, particularly Scott, the Frankensteiner. You know, he does a tiger bomb. That was wonderful to see. Mind you, his Frankensteiner was a standing Frankensteiner. Like, he jumped on the shoulders, I believe it was Michael P.S. Hayes, and did the Frankensteiner. And of course, the end of the match to where Freebirds is trying to get the upper hand with a distraction, but Rick Steiner uses it to his advantage to hit a overhead belly-to-belly suplex, and Scott gets the pin. Just a very fun match, probably my second favorite match of the night, and just had a lot of great fun to it. Our next match... Our next match was felt throwaways. Like, we wanted to have all these big names, and considering they're all going to be involved in the main event later in some capacity, basically it was just setting that up. Though, I will say this, Jim Ross's commentary on it was amazing. You had Paul Orndorff, the Junkyard Dog, and El Gigante, sans the furry Attack on Titan suit. That's the interesting thing nowadays. Think about it. Think about El Gigante in that furry sort of suit. It's like, does that not now remind you of Attack on Titans? Maybe somebody in WWE wasn't just stupid. Maybe somebody in WWE was psychic, and they were just like 25 years ahead of everybody else. But that's in there. But, you know, Orndorff, Junkyard Dog, and El Gigante versus the Four Horsemen at the time, which were Sid Vicious, the WCW Television Champion, Arn Anderson, the Enforcer, and Barry Windham. I will say this. I do like the match in general and the fact of how they worked with it. To where, you know, Arn and Barry and them would all get involved, and so would Sid. And basically them going against Arndorf and against Junkyard Dog. And it's like, the whole objective of the Horsemen were, don't let Gigante get in the match. And when I felt like Gigante was about to get in the match, they, like, I think they threw Junkyard Dog over the top rope and got intentionally disqualified. So this match was more about storytelling for the main event than it was an actual match. And just because of that nature, I felt it was the worst match of the night. But the storytelling that was part of it would eventually carry over to the main event of the night. Now we get to our three like championship main events. The first is Lex Luger versus Mark Callous with his manager, Paulie Dangerously, for the NWA United States title. Again, for those who don't know, let me put it this way. This is Lex Luger versus The Undertaker with his advocate, Paul Heyman. And can't you just imagine what, you know, if this match was taking place today, the Paul Heyman promos that would be like coming out. Let me try to channel this. Ladies and gentlemen, my name is Paul Heyman, and I am the advocate for the man who put the 21 in 21-1 at WrestleMania, The Undertaker. Now, Mr. Luger, you might think yourself a powerful person, but I guarantee you that it's a Sunday at the Great American Bash. No amount of flexing your pecs, Lex, will make a difference. As the Demon of Death Valley is going to walk in to Baltimore, Maryland, and you will rest in peace. So, please, as you get ready to face the Rabbi of the Undead, Mr. Lex Luger, please, shine yourself up real nice in your Narcissistic mirror. Jump on the Lex Express, put on your fanny pack, and get ready to meet your maker. Because when my Undertaker gets through with you, you will find yourself 6 feet under. And you will learn to not break God's 11th commandment. Don't piss off the Undertaker. Or it would go something along like that. Now, again, that whole nostalgic factor, I think, brings this match a sort of new energy that you wouldn't think of otherwise. I think during this time, nobody knew what would become a Mark Callous or Paulie Dangerously, or hell, even Lex Luger for that matter. But 25 years later, this match takes on a whole different feel to it because of what the individuals in this match would become and their importance in wrestling history. And it's like this very, like, mind fuck. It's like, oh my god, I'm watching The Undertaker as managed by Paul Heyman versus Lex Luger. And for the most part, it's an okay match. I'm not going to say it's like the greatest match ever, because it's far from that. You know, these were two power guys. At the time, Undertaker, aka Mark Callous's, you know, finisher was the Hard Punch. It was like a knockout, but because he had this whole biker gimmick. Wow, where have we seen that with The Undertaker before? So, considering that this is on the WWE Network, I am very shocked that they didn't have him coming out to rolling. But, It was a fun match because that the whole knowledge and nostalgia factor that gets added to it. And it's a good sort of power game, heel versus face, two power wrestlers. Undertaker trying to beat him down, get him ready for the hard punch, and but Luger eventually overpowering and hitting him with a surprise clothesline for the win. The finish is just, that's really the problem, is I feel the finish is weak. He does put Callis in the torture rack, but Paulie dangerously gets involved. But still, just the clothesline, the way it was set up, it's just, I felt, I don't know if that works. I also felt that the count was very quick on that clothesline. I feel like I'm Paul Heyman here trying to make excuses for The Undertaker why he lost. But again, it's like, that's how into it the match I was. I was just, this is one of those matches to where, by itself, the match isn't anything special. It really isn't. And it's not that it's bad, but it's not good. But at the same point in time, because of time, this match has taken on a whole new feeling. And there's just no way you can sit there and watch this match any other way, because you're sitting there knowing, like, holy shit, that's Lex Luger, that's The Undertaker, and that's Paul Heyman. So, the match itself is okay. It's right up there with sort of the beginning matches of the night. I would dare say it's actually one of the worst matches of the night, actually. Not the worst, but, like, there's really only one, like, average match. Every match on this pay-per-view is good. When you have a pay-per-view like that, it's calling something the worst, you know, you hate to say it, but it's, like, it's by nature of elimination. You gotta start, like, what were the worst matches? But, again, there's a different view to this match because of time, because of where we're watching it, through the WWE Network 25 years later, after the reign after 25 years of The Undertaker dominating the WWE, after ECW and everything that Paul Heyman has done, and everything that Lex Luger has done. Lex Luger was a rising star at this time, but again, we look at him differently because he became a big star later. In a couple years, during 94 and, you know, during the 90s. So just, there's some rose-tinted nostalgic glasses that are very hard to take off in watching this match. It's an okay match on this pay-per-view. It's actually one of the worst of the pay-per-view, but it's still a solid good match and solid championship match. But yeah, it's really hard to take off those rose-tinted glasses. Our next match is for the NWA World Tag Team Championship, as the team of the NWA World Tag Team Champions of Doom, a.k.a. Butch Reed and what I consider one of the greatest African-American wrestlers of all time, in Ron Simmons, the first NWA World Heavyweight Champion of African-American descent, in fact, with their manager, the master of "Let's make this a tag team match" player, Teddy Long, versus the Rock and Roll Express of Ricky Morton and Robert Gibson. This was a great match. I think it showcased Doom as this powerhouse that just beat you down. And a lot of the match was them dominating and beating down the Rock and Roll Express. And then they would have these bursts of excitement where they would get out of trouble, make the tag, and the fresh wrestler would come in. And would, you know, take over the energy until he got caught. And then, of course, the whole setup finished to where Butch Reed gets pushed into Teddy Long, who falls in the ring. And because, again, this is another one of those examples of the distraction. Robert Gibson gets distracted with Teddy Long and wanting to punch him in the face, which he does. And in the context, it allows Butch Reed to get up and hit the flying shoulder block off the top rope for the finisher. I just love the flow of that. And it just had this great energy, and it just, this was a great showcase of Doom, this up-and-coming new tag team who were tag team champions these future stars of the business. As Butch Reed, I think, had only been wrestling for about 5, possibly 6 years, and Richard Simmons fewer than that. I think at 3 or 4, actually. I could look up and see when he started wrestling. But again, they were still, compared to the Rock and Roll Express, who've been wrestling for probably over 10, let's see, he started, he decided to join, well, that's interesting, he was on the Tampa Bay Bandits, where he was teammates with Lex Luger. It keeps coming back to Luger, doesn't it? He joined in 1988, so, yeah, he'd really only been doing 2 years at this point. So it brings on this again, promoting those up and coming stars. Again, Butch Reed being the veteran, again, teaching Ron Simmons, who again had this great physique and great energy and chemistry. It's why he eventually became the NWA World Heavyweight Champion around 92, the first African American World Heavyweight Champion. Which, again, I would dare you to ask anybody that, like, who put the first African-American NWA World Heavyweight Champion? I guarantee most people wouldn't know. It was Ron Simmons. So, just a solid match. Great tag team match. Had a lot of energy to it. Really enjoyed it. That brings us to our main event. As Sting faces the NWA World Heavyweight Champion, Ric Flair. Now, there's a couple of caveats to talk about with this match. One, while it's a one-on-one match, the championship committee wanted to make sure that the Four Horsemen would not get involved. So the ring was surrounded with Sting's dudes with attitude, which kind of confused me and took my attention away from the match at the beginning because I kept looking for the dudes. I thought, like, I want to see John Laurinaitis. I go, you suck. And Shane Douglas, mind you, but that's not who they were talking about. It was Sting's dudes with attitudes, which was his handpicked people to help keep the ring safe. And that was Paul Orndorff, Junkyard Dog, and Rick and Scott Steiner. And their objective was to keep the Four Horsemen from coming to the ring. That's why they were surrounding the ring. Meanwhile, Ollie Anderson was to be handcuffed to El Gigante, and they would be sitting on the ramp. And that was just like fun. Like, you come or I hit you. It's like, okay. And they have these two seats on the entranceway, but El Gigante is so big he takes up both seats. And so there's Ollie, who is now a small man himself, like on the edge of one of the seats, like, I can't believe I'm in timeout. It's like, it's just hilarious to watch. This was classic Sting and Flair. It was a really good match. Great back and forth. The psychology is excellent in this match. If you wanna look back at Sting and Flair's battles, this is a great look into it. Especially the psychology, and, you know, throughout the match, Flair's working on that leg, trying to lock in the figure four. Never does get the figure four. And, of course, the ending of the match coming to where, again, he's worked on that knee, and it looks like Sting made a mistake where he goes for a Stinger Splash and misses and hits his knee, and he lures Flair in, thinking, like, I got the knee now, I can get the figure four, and goes to lock it in, and Sting turns it into a small package for the win. Of course, there would be the point where the Four Horsemen ran down, but the Steiners and Dog and Orndorff keep them and drive them away. So, again, it was a really good match. It's classic Flair and Sting. There is a problem that goes in with this match, though, and it's pretty much actually after the match. When Sting wins, I felt the celebration was underwhelming. And it's like, this is supposed to be a big moment. This is the Nature Boy being defeated for the title. And there was some celebration to it, and the crowd was into it. But it's like, they almost immediately leave for the ring for a commentary, and Sting comes back for like one or two woos. And it's like, there felt like there to be more grandiose to this celebration. Like, wrestlers coming out and cheering him for winning the title. Like, all the good faces. Like, Furnace and the Rock and Roll Express. You could have the Southern Boys or whoever was the face in that tag team battle or whatever. But it's just like, just the dude's attitude. It's like, hey, great job, buddy. It's like, yeah, I got the title. I'm going down the ramp to get interviewed by Golden Sully. So it felt like there could have been more there. And I felt like the celebration of Sting winning the NWA World Championship was very underwhelming. And to me, that kind of hurts the match because the celebration of winning the titles is an important part of a championship match. I know that may seem nitpicky, but at the same point in time, it's part of it. You know, when Hogan defeats Andre at WrestleMania 3, and he's celebrating his retain of the title, you know, there's grandiose there. He just defeated Andre the Giant. And he's like, yeah, and he's playing to the crowd, and there's that great point to where he's like, where he's like, come on, we'll go again, Andre. We can go another 12 rounds if you want to. Which John Cena would later pick up as a movie. But no, like, come in, it's just like, and he's like snapping his fingers to the music, and he's like playing air guitar, and he's playing to the crowd, and he's posing. And there's grandiose and gravious to it as well. And it's just, it feels like it's a championship win. You could probably fool me that this was a championship win. Because it didn't feel like a championship win. Like, he's holding the championship and like, oh yeah, great job, and there's some fireworks. But it's like, the grandiose is very much lacking for such a major win. I mean, this is Sting, the next generation, beating Ric Flair. It's the man, the so-called man of the 90s, defeating the man of the 80s. You know, again, going back, when Dusty Rhodes almost won it in that second Starrcade, which we will be probably watching this year and reviewing this year, you know, the excitement, because I've seen it, and the excitement there that he won was just amazing. It's like, when it gets announced that he didn't win, I mean, I think we did watch it, mind you. I think we did both 84 and 85. I think we did. But still, just that was there. And then the eventual learning that, no, he doesn't. When Ric Flair won in 83, like, the way people were, like, storming the ring, it's like, you want some gravitas there. So that really kind of takes the match down and makes it may be a petty thing, but because it is a really good match. Was just like, you know, I was expecting more of a celebration. So that's it. I really enjoyed this pay-per-view. I mean, this is a really good pay-per-view. Top moments? Wow, really hard to think of moments. Because there's really no, like, moments. Like, there's no, like, a lot of the finishes are roll-ups and, like, things. I guess number three would be Butch Reed's flying shoulder block. That was a big moment. I mean, seeing that big guy come off the top with that shoulder block was huge. That's number three, I would say. Number two would be, man, it's very, very tough to say. You know what? I got it. Number two is the sight of Ollie Anderson handcuffed to El Gigante, because it's just so freaking hilarious. That where, you know, El Gigante is taking up like 1.5 seats, and like there's Ollie, like I said, no small man himself, taking up the edge of a seat, like looking like he's on timeout. It's absolutely hilarious. But what would be number one? You know what? Number one for me, I have to give it to it. It's just the mind fuck factor of sitting there and seeing Lex Luger in the same ring with The Undertaker, and in Undertaker's corner being Paul Heyman. it is such a mind fuck. It's a moment in itself. So those are my top three moments, which I hate to say because, like I said, the wrestling was superb, and just but like all the big moves and everything happened during the match. And again, it was just more athletic in the finishes, to where a lot of them were roll ups and cross body splashes and top rope. Again, that's why the Butch Reed one is probably the one that stands out the most, because it's the most amazing of all the finishes of the night. Probably followed quickly behind Rick Steiner's over-the-head belly-to-belly suplex. And if I had to name one more move, Doug Fearns's belly-to-belly suplex. As for my top three matches, oh, God, another hard one. Wow, you know what? Number three, Doug Furness and Dirty Dutch Mantel. It really is a good match. Had a lot of time. Had a great setup to the finish. Great back and forth energy with it. I really enjoyed it. Number two, the Steiner Brothers versus the Fabulous Freebirds. Great tag team match. A lot of energy. Two classic tag team facing off. But number one, like I said, just because of that kinetic energy and everything, the Midnight Express versus the Wild Ass Southern Boys. It's just got so much energy to it. Again, if you've ever seen, you know, the Fabulous Freebirds versus the Von Erichs, and that kinetic, like, brawling free energy to it, that kinetic energy, it's like, it's got that same thing here, and just, oh, God, it's a wonderful match, and I was so into it. It's like, I didn't care who won, but I was like, I was so into it because of that kinetic energy. So, those are my top three matches. End of the day, this is a great pay-per-view. If you are looking into, like, wanting to see, want a great NWA pay-per-view before WCW, or maybe turn right before that time to the change to WCW, this is a great pay-per-view to watch. It's a great pay-per-view to watch because it has a lot of nostalgia for the past with some wrestlers of the 80s wrestling, like the Iron Sheik, Mike Rotunda, Harley Race, Tommy Wildfire Rich, the Midnight Express, the Rock and Roll Express. While at the same point in time, it's highlighting a lot of their future stars at the time, like Mark Callows, Doom, Sting, Doug Furness, Flying Brian Pillman. So it's highlighting the future while celebrating the past. And at the end of the day, just there's a lot of great wrestling in this pay-per-view. Like I said, the only match that was really at all bad was the six-man tag match between the Horsemen and Orndorff, Junkyard Dog, and El Gigante. But again, that's because just it felt like it never went anywhere. But every match on the card was just really good wrestling, blurred those lines between sport and entertainment really well. And I cannot highly suggest watching this pay-per-view. I think if you have a sort of you want to do like a patriotic playlist of great patriotic pay-per-views, I think this is one definitely to put in the playlist, like building up to 4th of July. So, I give WCW the Great American Bash of 1990 a 4.5 out of 5. It's just really, really good pay-per-view. And I highly suggest watching it. So, that is it for this episode of CM Juice Wrestling Reviews. Remember, there's a ways to contact the show. You can email us at absolutionnetwork132@gmail.com. You can find us on Stitcher, which I know I have to get to. Hopefully we'll try to get to in August. I'm just so busy these days. But you have that. You can contact us there. You can leave us a message on our Facebook, which you can find at www.facebook.com and search for the Absolution Network. And of course, you can always leave a comment on the website itself, which you can find at www.an.132productions.com. Also, while you're here, check out all the other 132 Productions content. Of course, includes John Bromos and his Toku videos, the anime cast with Relic, the Otaku Momentum, And of course, Shin Tiger Kuro, his anime, you know, he's doing a big thing on One Piece video game that's coming out. And of course, his usual wrestling videos, including his Raw reviews, if I can call him that, though he has another name for him. He always has a fun title where he just goes over Raw and his other wrestling videos. And then, of course, all my other stuff. That, of course, includes Tom Prerogative, the Intergalactic Graphic Review, Tom's Top 10, whenever I decide to do at least one of those and have time. And, of course, many other stuff. This, of course, includes podcasts on the other family sites of the Absolution Network, like Comic Book Crazy, which you can find at www.comicbookcrazy.132productions.com. And, of course, my Tokyo SOS, a Godzilla podcast that you can find at www.tokyosos.132productions.com. So there's that. Check all of that out. And of course, check out all our friends on the sidebar. They, of course, includes Michael Bailey and Fuse in the Long Box, Spidey Dude and the Clone Sucker Chronicles, Steven Syker and the Major Spoilers and Critical Hit Podcast, and of course, Scott Gardner and the 2-2 Freaks Podcasting Network. And that is it for this episode of CM Jude's Wrestling Reviews. Next week, because more likely I'm not getting one out next week. But, next time I come to you, it's gonna be a bash at the beach. In particular, it's gonna be Bash in the Beach 1997. So, we're going late 90s classic good WCW. So, Bash at the Beach, 1997. So, until next time, all my wrestling fans, I want you to remember one goddamn thing about me. CM Jew. I'm the best Jew in the world!
You're all that I have and you're all that I need. Each and every day I pray to get to know you. Please wanna be close to you. Yes, I'm so hungry. You're like water for my soul when it gets thirsty. Without you, there's no me or the air that I breathe. Sometimes the world is dark and I just can't see. With these demons around all around, they bring me down to negative vibes. I believe, yes, I believe, I say that I believe. I stand on two feet, one knee, brought down on one knee. I fight with all of my might to get these demons to flee. Hashem's rays, fire blaze, burn bright in, I believe. Hashem's rays, fire blaze, burn bright in, I believe. Out of darkness comes light, twilight and through the heights. Crown lights burning up, out of through the twilight. So thank you to my God, now I finally got it right. And I fight with all of my heart and all of my soul and all of my mind. Speeding my love will be for holding and sealing. I give myself to you from the essence of my being. And I sing to my God, songs of love and healing. I want Mashiach now. Time it starts a feeling. What's this feeling? My love will be for holding and sealing. I give myself to you from the essence of my being. And I sing to my God, songs of love and healing. I want Mashiach now. Stripping away the layers and reveal your soul. You gotta give yourself up and then you become whole. You're a slave to yourself and them don't even know. Them wanna live that fast life.